putting to death people who offended his aesthetic tastes and didn't fit his image of the perfect Swedish race. In other words, he was appealing for wholesale murder in a text that was written in impeccable academic prose and contained all the required medical arguments. Get rid of those who are handicapped. Don't allow the Sami people to spread. They have a Mongolian influence. People who are mentally ill would regard death as a form of liberation, wouldn't they? Loose women, vagrants, gypsies, and Jews. You can imagine. In my brother's fantasies, Auschwitz could have been located in Dalarna. After the war, Gregor Wanger became a secondary school teacher and eventually the headmaster of the Hedestad Preparatory School. Wanger thought that he no longer belonged to any party after the war and had given up Nazism. He died in 1974, and it wasn't until he went through his brother's correspondence that he learned that in the 50s, Gregor had joined the politically ineffectual but totally crackpot sect called the Nordic National Party. He had remained a member until his death. Quote, Henrik Wanger, tape 204167.
Consequently, three of my brothers were politically insane. How sick were they in other respects?
The only brother worthy of a measure of empathy in Wanger's eyes was the sickly Gustav, who died of lung disease in 1955. Gustav had never been interested in politics, and he seemed to be some sort of misanthropic, artistic soul with absolutely no interest in business or working in the Wanger Corporation. Blomqvist asked Wanger, "Now you and Harold are the only ones left. Why did he move back to Hedeby?"
"He moved home in 1979. He owns that house."
"It must feel strange living so close to a brother that you hate."
"I don't hate my brother. If anything, I may pity him. He's a complete idiot, and he's the one who hates me."
"He hates you?"
"Precisely. I think that's why he came back here. So that he could spend his last years hating me at close quarters."
"Why does he hate you?"
"Because I got married."
"I think you're going to have to explain that." Wanger had lost contact with his older brothers early on. He was the only brother to show an aptitude for business. He was his father's last hope. He had no interest in politics and steered clear of Uppsala. Instead, he studied economics in Stockholm. After he turned 18, he spent every break and summer holiday working at one of the offices within the Wanger Corporation or working with the management of one of its companies. He became familiar with all the labyrinths of the family business. On the 10th of June 1941, in the midst of an all-out war, Wanger was sent to Germany for a 6-week visit at the Wanger Corporation business offices in Hamburg. He was only 21, and the Wanger's German agent, a company veteran by the name of Hermann Lobach, was his chaperone and mentor.
"I won't tire you with all the details, but when I went there, Hitler and Stalin were still good friends, and there wasn't yet an Eastern Front. Everyone still believed that Hitler was invincible. There was a feeling of both optimism and desperation. I think those are the right words. More than half a century later, it's still difficult to put words to the mood. But don't get me wrong. I was not a Nazi, and in my eyes, Hitler seemed like some absurd character in an operetta. But it would have been almost impossible not to be infected by the optimism about the future, which was rife among ordinary people in Hamburg. Despite the fact that the war was getting closer, and several bombing raids were carried out against Hamburg during the time I was there, the people seemed to think it was mostly a temporary annoyance, that soon there would be peace, and Hitler would establish his Neuropa. People wanted to believe that Hitler was God. That's what it sounded like in the propaganda."
Wanger opened one of his many photograph albums.
"This is Lobach. He disappeared in 1944, presumably lost in some bombing raid. We never knew what his fate was. During my weeks in Hamburg, I became close to him. I was staying with him and his family in an elegant apartment in a well-to-do neighborhood of Hamburg. We spent time together every day. He was no more a Nazi than I was, but for convenience, he was a member of the party. His membership card opened doors and facilitated opportunities for the Wanger Corporation, and business was precisely what we did. We built freight wagons for their trains. I've always wondered whether any of our wagons were destined for Poland. We sold fabric for their uniforms and tubes for their radio sets, although officially we didn't know what they were using the goods for. and Lobach knew how to land a contract. He was entertaining and good-natured, the perfect Nazi. Gradually I began to see that he was also a man who was desperately trying to hide a secret. In the early hours of June 22nd in 1941, Lobach knocked on the door of my bedroom. My room was next to his wife's bedroom, and he signalled me to be quiet, get dressed, and come with him. We went downstairs and sat in the smoking salon. Lobach had been up all night. He had the radio on, and I realized that something serious had happened. Operation Barbarossa had begun. Germany had invaded the Soviet Union on Midsummer Eve. Wanger gestured in resignation. Lobach took out two glasses and poured a generous aquavit for each of us. He was obviously shaken. When I asked him what it all meant, he replied with foresight that it meant the end for Germany and Nazism. I only half believed him. Hitler seemed undefeatable after all, but Lobach and I drank a toast to the fall of Germany. Then he turned his attention to practical matters. Blomqvist nodded to signal that he was still following the story. First, he had no possibility of contacting my father for instructions, but on his own initiative he had decided to cut short my visit to Germany and send me home. Second, he asked me to do something for him. Wanger pointed to a yellowed portrait of a dark-haired woman in three-quarter view. Lobach had been married for 40 years, but in 1919 he met a wildly beautiful woman half his age, and he fell hopelessly in love with her. She was a poor, simple seamstress. Lobach courted her, and like so many other wealthy men, he could afford to install her in an apartment a convenient distance from his office. She became his mistress. In 1921 she had a daughter who was christened Edith. Rich older men, poor young woman, and a love child. That can't have caused much of a scandal in the '40s, Blomqvist said. Absolutely right. If it hadn't been for one thing, the woman was Jewish, and consequently Lobach was a father of a Jew in the midst of Nazi Germany. He was what they called a traitor to his race.
Ah, that does change the situation. What happened?
Edith's mother had been picked up in 1939. She disappeared, and we can only guess what her fate was. It was known, of course, that she had a daughter who was not yet included on any transport list, and who was now being sought by the Department of the Gestapo, whose job it was to track down fugitive Jews. In the summer of 1941, the week that I arrived in Hamburg, Edith's mother was somehow linked to Lobach, and he was summoned for an interview. He acknowledged the relationship and his paternity, but he stated that he had no idea where his daughter might be, and he had not had any contact with her in 10 years.
So where was the daughter?
I had seen her every day in the Lobach's home. A sweet and quiet 20-year-old girl who cleaned my room and helped serve dinner. By 1937 the persecution of the Jews had been going on for several years, and Edith's mother had begged Lobach for help. And he did help. Lobach loved his illegitimate child just as much as his legitimate children. He hid her in the most unlikely place he could think of, right in front of everyone's nose. He had arranged for counterfeit documents, and he had taken her in as their housekeeper.
Did his wife know who she was?
No, it seemed she had no idea. It had worked for 4 years, but now Lobach felt the noose tightening. It was only a matter of time before the Gestapo would come knocking on the door. Then he went to get his daughter, and introduced her to me as such. She was very shy, and didn't even dare look me in the eye. She must have been up half the night waiting to be called. Lobach begged me to save her life.
How?
He had arranged the whole thing. I was supposed to be staying another 3 weeks, and then to take the night train to Copenhagen, and continue by ferry across the Sound, a relatively safe trip even in wartime. But 2 days after our conversation, a freighter owned by the Wanger Corporation was to leave Hamburg headed for Sweden. Lobach wanted to send me with the freighter instead, to leave Germany without delay. The change in my travel plans had to be approved by the security service. It was a formality, but not a problem. But Lobach wanted me on board that freighter.
Together with Edith, I presume.
Edith was smuggled on board, hidden inside one of 300 crates containing machinery. My job was to protect her if she should be discovered while we were still in German territorial waters, and to prevent the captain of the ship from doing anything stupid. Otherwise I was supposed to wait until we were a good distance from Germany before I let her out.
It sounds terrifying.
It sounded simple to me, but it turned into a nightmare journey. The captain was called Oscar Granath, and he was far from pleased to be made responsible for his employer's snotty little heir. We left Hamburg around 9 in the evening in late June. We were just making our way out of the inner harbour when the air raid sirens went off, a British bombing raid, the heaviest I had then experienced. And the harbour was, of course, the main target. But somehow we got through, and after an engine breakdown and a miserably stormy night in minefield waters, we arrived the following afternoon at Karlskrona. You're probably going to ask me what happened to the girl.
I think I know.
My father was understandably furious. I had put everything at risk with my idiotic venture, and the girl could have been deported from Sweden at any time. But I was already just as hopelessly in love with her as Loback had been with her mother. I proposed to her and gave my father an ultimatum. Either he accepted our marriage, or he'd have to look for another fatted calf for the family business. He gave in.
But she died?
Yes. Far too young, in 1958. She had a congenital heart defect, and it turned out that I couldn't have children. And that's why my brother hates me.
Because you married her?
Because, to use his own words, I married a filthy Jewish whore.
But he's insane.
I couldn't have put it better myself.
Chapter 10. Thursday, January 9th to Friday, January 31st. According to the Hedestad Courier, Blomqvist's first month out in the country was the coldest in recorded memory, or, as Wanger informed him, at least since the wartime winter of 1942. After only a week in Hedeby, he had learned all about long underwear, woolly socks, and double undershirts. He had several miserable days in the middle of the month when the temperature dropped to minus 35 degrees Fahrenheit. He had experienced nothing like it, not even during the year he spent in Kiruna, in Lapland, doing his military service. One morning the water pipes froze. Nielsen gave him 2 big plastic containers of water for cooking and washing, but the cold was paralyzing. Ice flowers formed on the insides of the windows, and no matter how much wood he put in the stove, he was still cold. He spent a long time each day splitting wood in the shed next to the house. At times he was on the brink of tears, and toyed with taking the first train heading south. Instead he would put on one more sweater and wrap up in a blanket as he sat at the kitchen table, drinking coffee and reading old police reports. Then the weather changed, and the temperature rose steadily to a balmy 14 degrees Fahrenheit. Mikhail was beginning to get to know people in Hedeby. Martin Wanger kept his promise and invited him for a meal of moose steak. His lady friend joined them for dinner. Eva was a warm, sociable and entertaining woman. Blomqvist found her extraordinarily attractive. She was a dentist and lived in Hedestad, but she spent the weekends at Martin's home. Blomqvist gradually learned that they had known each other for many years, but that they had not started going out together until they were middle-aged. Evidently they saw no reason to marry.
"She's actually my dentist," said Martin with a laugh.
"And marrying into this crazy family isn't really my thing," Eva said, patting Martin affectionately on the knee.
Martin Wanger's villa was furnished in black, white, and chrome. There were expensive designer pieces that would have delighted the connoisseur, Christa Malm. The kitchen was equipped to a professional chef's standard. In the living room there was a high-end stereo with an impressive collection of jazz records from Tommy Dorsey to John Coltrane. Martin Wanger had money, and his home was both luxurious and functional. It was also impersonal. The artwork on the walls was reproductions and posters of the sort found in IKEA. The bookshelves, at least in the part of the house that Blomqvist saw, housed a Swedish encyclopedia and some coffee table books that people might have given him as Christmas presents for want of a better idea. All in all, he could discern only 2 personal aspects of Martin Wanger's life, music and cooking. His 3,000 or so LPs spoke for one, and the other could be deduced from the fact of Martin's stomach bulging over his belt. The man himself was a mixture of simplicity, shrewdness, and amiability. It took no great analytical skill to conclude that the corporate CEO was a man with problems. As they listened to Night in Tunisia, the conversation was devoted to the Wanger Corporation,
and Martin made no secret of the fact that the company was fighting for survival. He was certainly aware that his guest was a financial reporter whom he hardly knew, yet he discussed the internal problems of his company so openly that it seemed reckless. Perhaps he assumed that Blomqvist was one of the family, since he was working for his great-uncle, and like the former CEO, Martin took the view that the family members only had themselves to blame for the situation in which the company found itself. On the other hand, he seemed almost amused by his family's incorrigible folly. Eva nodded, but passed no judgment of her own. They had obviously been over the same ground before. Martin accepted the story that Blomqvist had been hired to write a family chronicle, and he inquired how the work was going. Blomqvist said with a smile that he was having the most trouble remembering the names of all the relatives. He asked if he might come back to do an interview in due course. Twice he considered turning the conversation to the old man's obsession with Harriet's disappearance. Wanger must have pestered her brother with his theories, and Martin must realize that if Blomqvist was going to write about the Wangers, he could not ignore the fact that one family member had vanished in dramatic circumstances. But Martin showed no sign of wanting to discuss the subject. The evening ended, after several rounds of vodka, at 2 in the morning. Blomqvist was fairly drunk as he skidded the 300 yards to the guest house. It had been a pleasant evening. One afternoon, during Blomqvist's second week in Hedeby, there was a knock on the door. He put aside the binder from the police report that he had just opened, the 6th in the series, and closed the door to his office before he opened the front door to a blonde woman well wrapped up against the cold. "Hi. I just thought I'd come and say hello. I'm Cecilia Wanger." They shook hands, and he got out the coffee cups. Cecilia, daughter of Harold Wanger, appeared to be an open and engaging woman. Blomqvist remembered that Wanger had spoken of her appreciatively. He had also said that she was not on speaking terms with her father, her next-door neighbour. They chatted for a while before she brought up the reason for her visit. "I understand that you're writing a book about the family," she said. "I'm not sure that I care for the idea. I wanted to see what sort of person you are."
"Well, Henrik Wanger hired me. It's his story, so to speak."
"And our good Henrik isn't exactly neutral in his attitude towards the family."
Blomqvist studied her, unsure what she was getting at.
"You're opposed to having a book written about the Wanger family?"
"I didn't say that. And it doesn't really matter what I think. But by now you must have realized that it hasn't always been plain sailing to be part of this family."
Blomqvist had no idea what Wanger had said, or how much Cecilia knew about his assignment. He threw out his hands.
"I'm contracted by your uncle to write a family chronicle. He has some very colourful views about members of the family, but I'll be sticking strictly to what can be documented."
Cecilia Wanger smiled, but without warmth.
"What I want to know is, will I have to go into exile, or emigrate, when the book comes out?"
"I don't expect so," Blomqvist said. "People will be able to tell the sheep from the goats."
"Like my father, for instance."
"Your father, the famous Nazi?" Blomqvist said. Cecilia Wanger rolled her eyes.
"My father is crazy. I only see him a few times a year."
"Why don't you want to see him?"
"Wait a minute, before you start in asking a lot of questions. Are you planning to quote anything I say, or can I carry on a normal conversation with you?"
"My job is to write a book starting with Alexander Vangirsad's arrival in Sweden with Bernadotte, and going up to the present. It's to cover the business empire over many decades. But it will also discuss why the empire is in difficulty, and it will touch on the animosity that exists within the family. In such a survey, it's impossible to avoid having some dirty linen float to the surface. But that doesn't mean that I'm going to set out to present a malicious portrait of anyone. For example, I've met Martin Wanger. He seems to me a very sympathetic person, and that's how I'm going to describe him."
Cecilia Wanger did not reply.
"What I know about you is that you're a teacher."
"It's actually worse than that. I'm the headmistress of Hedestad Preparatory School."
"I'm sorry. I know that your uncle is fond of you and that you're married but separated. And that's about all so far. So do please go ahead and talk to me without fear of being quoted. I'm sure I'll come knocking on your door some day soon. Then it will be an official interview and you can choose whether you want to answer my questions or not."
"So I can talk to you then or now? Off the record, as they say?"
"Of course."
"And this is off the record?"
Of course. This is a social visit, after all.
Okay. Then can I ask you something?
Please.
How much of this book is going to deal with Harriet?
Blomqvist bit his lip and then said, as casually as he could, "To be honest, I have no idea. It might fill a chapter. It was a dramatic event that has cast a shadow over your uncle at the very least.
But you're not here to look into her disappearance."
"What makes you think that?"
"Well, the fact that Nielsen lugged four massive boxes over here, that could be Henrik's private investigations over the years. I looked in Harriet's old room where Henrik keeps it, and it was gone."
Cecilia Wanger was no fool. "You'll have to take the matter up with Henrik, not with me," Blomqvist said. "But it won't surprise you to know that Henrik has talked a lot about the girl's disappearance, and I thought it would be interesting to read through what had been collected." Cecilia gave him another of her joyless smiles.
"I wonder sometimes who's crazier, my father or my uncle. I must have listened to him on Harriet's disappearance 1,000 times."
"What do you think happened to her?"
"Is this an interview question?"
"No," he said with a laugh. "I'm just curious."
"What I'm curious about is whether you're in that case too, whether you've swallowed Henrik's conviction, or whether in fact you're the one who's egging him on."
"You think that Henrik's a nutcase?"
"Don't get me wrong. He's one of the warmest and most thoughtful people I know. I'm very fond of him. But on this particular topic, he's obsessive."
"But Harriet really did disappear."
"I'm just so damn sick of the whole story. It's poisoned our lives for decades, and it doesn't stop doing so."
She got up abruptly and put on her fur coat.
"I have to go. You seem like a pleasant sort. Martin thinks so too, but his judgment isn't always reliable. You're welcome to come for coffee at my house whenever you like. I'm almost always home in the evening."
"Thank you," Blomqvist said. "You didn't answer the question that wasn't an interview question." She paused at the door and replied without looking at him.
"I have no idea. I think it was an accident that has such a simple explanation that it will astonish us if we ever find out."
She turned to smile at him, for the first time with warmth. Then she was gone. If it had been an agreeable first meeting with Cecilia Wanger, the same could not be said of his first encounter with Isabella. Harriet's mother was exactly as Henrik Wanger had warned. She proved to be an elegant woman who reminded him vaguely of Lauren Bacall. She was thin, dressed in a black Persian lamb coat with matching cap, and she was leaning on a black cane when Blomqvist ran into her one morning on his way to Suzanne's. She looked like an aging vampire, still strikingly beautiful but as venomous as a snake. Isabella Wanger was apparently on her way home after taking a walk. She called to him from the crossroad.
"Hello there, young man. Come here."
The commanding tone was hard to mistake. Blomqvist looked around and concluded that he was the one summoned. He did as instructed.
"I am Isabella Wanger," the woman said.
"Hello, my name is Mikael Blomqvist." He stuck out his hand, which she ignored.
"Are you that person who's been snooping around in our family affairs?"
"Well, if you mean am I the person that Henrik Wanger has put under contract to help him with his book about the Wanger family, then yes."
"That's none of your business."
"Which? The fact that Henrik Wanger offered me a contract, or the fact that I accepted?"
"You know perfectly well what I mean. I don't care for people poking around in my life."
"I won't poke around in your life. The rest you'll have to discuss with Henrik." Isabella raised her cane and pressed a handle against Mikhail's chest. She did not use much force, but he took a step back in surprise.
"Just you keep away from me," she said,
and turned on her heel and walked unsteadily towards her house. Blomqvist went on standing where he was, looking like a man who had just met a real-life comic book character. When he looked up, he saw Wanger in the window of his office. In his hand he was holding a cup, which he raised in an ironic salute. The only travelling that Blomqvist did during that first month was a drive to a bay on Lake Sillion. He borrowed Froda's Mercedes and drove through a snowy landscape to spend the afternoon with Detective Superintendent Morell. Blomqvist had tried to form an impression of Morell based on the way he came across in the police report. What he found was a wiry old man who moved softly and spoke even more slowly. Blomqvist brought with him a notebook with 10 questions,
mainly ideas that had cropped up while he was reading the police report. Morel answered each question put to him in a schoolmasterly way. Finally, Blomqvist put away his notes and explained that the questions were simply an excuse for a meeting. What he really wanted was to have a chat with him and ask one crucial question. Was there any single thing in the investigation that had not been included in the written report? Any hunches, even, that the inspector might be willing to share with him? Because Morel, like Wanger, had spent 36 years pondering the mystery, Blomqvist had expected a certain resistance. He was the new man who had come in and started tramping around in the thicket where Morel had gone astray. But there was not a hint of hostility. Morel methodically filled his pipe and lit it before he replied.
"Well, yes, obviously I had my own ideas, but they're so vague and fleeting that I can hardly put them into words."
"What do you think happened?"
"I think Harriet was murdered. Henrik and I agree on that. It's the only reasonable explanation. But we never discovered what the motive might have been. I think she was murdered for a very specific reason. It wasn't some act of madness or a rape or anything like that. If we had known the motive, we'd have known who killed her."
Morel stopped to think for a moment.
"The murder may have been committed spontaneously. By that I mean that someone seized an opportunity when it presented itself in the coming and going in the wake of the accident. The murderer hid the body, and then at some later time removed it while we were searching for her."
"We're talking about someone who has nerves of ice."
"There's one detail. Harriet went to Henrik's room wanting to speak to him. In hindsight, it seems to me a strange way to behave. She knew he had his hands full with all the relatives who were hanging around. I think Harriet alive represented a grave threat to someone, that she was going to tell Henrik something and that the murderer knew she was about to, well, spill the beans."
"And Henrik was busy with several family members?"
"There were four people in the room besides Henrik. His brother Gregor, a cousin named Magnus Sjögren, and two of Harald's children, Birger and Cecilia. But that doesn't tell us anything. Let's suppose that Harriet had discovered that someone had embezzled money from the company. Hypothetically, of course. She may have known about it for months, and at some point she may even have discussed it with the person in question. She may have tried to blackmail him, or she may have felt sorry for him and felt uneasy about exposing him. She may have decided all of a sudden and told the murderer so, and he, in desperation, killed her."
"You've said he and him."
"The book says that most killers are men. But it's also true that in the Wanger family are several women who are real firebrands."
"I've met Isabella."
"She's one of them. But there are others. Cecilia Wanger can be extremely caustic. Have you met Sarah Sjögren?"
Blomqvist shook his head.
"She's the daughter of Sophia Wanger, one of Henrik's cousins. In her case, we're talking about a truly unpleasant and inconsiderate lady, but she was living in Malmö, and as far as I could ascertain, she had no motive for killing the girl."
"So she's off the list."
"The problem is that no matter how we twisted and turned things, we never came up with a motive. That's the important thing."
"You put a vast amount of work into this case. Was there any lead you remember not having followed up?" Morel chuckled.
"No. I've devoted an endless amount of time to this case, and I can't think of anything that I didn't follow up to the bitter, fruitless end, even after I was promoted and moved away from Hedestad."
"Moved away?"
"Yes. I'm not from Hedestad originally. I served there from 1963 until 1968. After that, I was promoted to superintendent and moved to the Gävle police department for the rest of my career. But even in Gävle, I went on digging into the case."
"I don't suppose that Henrik would ever let up."
"That's true, but that's not the reason. The puzzle about Harriet still fascinates me to this day. I mean, it's like this. Every police officer has his own unsolved mystery. I remember from my days in Hedestad how older colleagues would talk in the canteen about the case of Rebecca. There was one officer in particular, a man named Torstensson.
He's been dead for years, who year after year kept returning to that case, in his free time and when he was on holiday. Whenever there was a period of calm among the local hooligans, he would take out those folders and study them.
Was that also a case about a missing girl? Morell looked surprised. Then he smiled when he realized that Blomqvist was looking for some sort of connection.
No, that's not why I mentioned it. I'm talking about the soul of a policeman. The Rebecca case was something that happened before Harriet Wanger was even born, and the statute of limitations has long since run out. Sometime in the 40s, a woman was assaulted in Hedestad, raped and murdered. That's not altogether uncommon. Every officer at some point in his career has to investigate that kind of crime. But what I'm talking about are those cases that stay with you and get under your skin during the investigation. This girl was killed in the most brutal way. The killer tied her up and stuck her head into the smouldering embers of a fireplace. One can only guess how long it took for the poor girl to die, or what torment she must have endured.
Christ almighty.
Exactly. It was so sadistic. Poor Torstensson was the first detective on the scene after she was found, and the murder remained unsolved, even though experts were called in from Stockholm. He could never let go of that case.
I can understand that.
My Rebecca case was Harriet. In this instance, we don't even know how she died. We can't even prove the murder was committed. But I have never been able to let it go.
He paused to think for a moment.
Being a homicide detective can be the loneliest job in the world. The friends of the victims are upset and in despair, but sooner or later, after weeks or months, they go back to their everyday lives. For the closest family, it takes longer, but for the most part, to some degree, they too get over their grieving and despair. Life has to go on. It does go on. But the unsolved murders keep gnawing away, and in the end there's only one person left who thinks night and day about the victim. It's the officer who's left with the investigation.
Three other people in the Wanger family lived on Hedeby Island. Alexander Wanger, son of Gregor, born in 1946, lived in a renovated wooden house. Wanger told Blomqvist that Alexander was presently in the West Indies, where he gave himself over to his favourite pastimes, sailing and whiling away the time, not doing a scrap of work. Alexander had been 20, and he had been there on that day. Alexander shared the house with his mother, Gerda, 80 years old and widow of Gregor Wanger. Blomqvist had never seen her. She was mostly bedridden. The third family member was Harold Wanger. During his first month, Blomqvist had not managed even a glimpse of him. Harold's house, the one closest to Blomqvist's cabin, looked gloomy and ominous, with its blackout curtains drawn across all the windows. Blomqvist sometimes thought he saw a ripple in the curtains as he passed, and once, when he was about to go to bed late, he noticed a glimmer of light coming from a room upstairs. There was a gap in the curtains. For more than 20 minutes he stood in the dark at his own kitchen window and watched the light before he got fed up and, shivering, went to bed. In the morning the curtains were back in place. Harold seemed to be an invisible but ever-present spirit who affected life in the village by his absence. In Blomqvist's imagination, Harold increasingly took on the form of an evil golem who spied on his surroundings from behind the curtains and devoted himself to no-one-knew-what matters in his barricaded cavern. Harold was visited once a day by the Home Help Service, usually an elderly woman, from the other side of the bridge. She would bring bags of groceries, trudging through the snowdrifts up to his door. Nielsen shook his head when Blomqvist asked about Harold. He had offered to do the shoveling, he said, but Harold did not want anyone to set foot on his property. Only once, during the first winter after Harold had returned to Hedeby Island, did Nielsen drive the tractor up there to clear the snow from the courtyard, just as he did for all the other driveways. Harold had come out of his house at a startling pace, yelling and gesticulating until Nielsen went away. Unfortunately, Nielsen was unable to clear Blomqvist's yard because the gate was too narrow for the tractor. A snow shovel and manual labour were still the only way to do it. In the middle of January, Blomqvist asked his lawyer to find out when he was going to be expected to serve his 3 months in prison. He was anxious to take care of the matter as quickly as possible.
Getting into prison turned out to be easier than he had expected. After a very few weeks of discussion, it was decreed that Blomqvist present himself on March 17th at the Rulåker prison outside Östersund, a minimum security prison. The lawyer advised him that the sentence would very likely be shortened.
"Fine," Blomqvist said, without much enthusiasm.
He sat at the kitchen table and petted the cat, who now arrived every few days to spend the night with Blomqvist. From the Nilsons he had learned that the cat's name was Tjorven. It did not belong to anyone in particular, it just made the rounds of all the houses. Blomqvist met his employer almost every afternoon. Sometimes they would have a brief conversation, sometimes they would sit together for hours. The conversation often consisted of Blomqvist putting up a theory that Wanger would then shoot down. Blomqvist tried to maintain a certain distance from his assignment, but there were moments when he found himself hopelessly fascinated by the enigma of the girl's disappearance. Blomqvist had assured Berger that he would also formulate a strategy for taking up the battle with Wennerström, but after a month in Hedestad, he had not yet opened the files which had brought him to the dock in the district court. On the contrary, he had deliberately pushed the matter aside because every time he thought about Wennerström and his own situation, he would sink into depression and listlessness. He wondered whether he was going crazy, like the old man. His professional reputation had imploded, and his means of recovering was to hide himself away in a tiny town in the deep country, chasing ghosts. Wanger could tell that Blomqvist was on some days a bit off balance. By the end of January, the old man made a decision that surprised even himself. He picked up the telephone and called Stockholm. The conversation lasted 20 minutes, and dealt largely with Mikael Blomqvist. It had taken almost a whole month for Berger's fury to subside. At 9:30 in the evening on one of the last days in January, she called him.
"Are you really intending to stay up there?" she began.
The call was such a surprise that Blomqvist could not at first reply. Then he smiled and wrapped the blanket tighter around himself.
"Hi, Ricky. You should try it yourself."
"Why would I? What is so charming about living in the back of beyond?"
"I just brushed my teeth with ice water. It makes my fillings hurt."
"You have only yourself to blame, but it's cold as hell down here in Stockholm, too."
"Let's hear the worst."
"We've lost 2/3 of our regular advertisers. No one wants to come right out and say it, but..."
"I know. Make a list of the ones that jump ship. Some day we'll do a good story on them."
"Mika, I've run the numbers, and if we don't rope in some new advertisers, we'll be bust by the autumn. It's as simple as that."
"Things will turn around."
She laughed wearily on the other end of the line.
"That's not something you can say, nestling up there in Laplander hell."
"Erika,
I know. A man's got to do what a man's got to do and all that crap. You don't have to say anything. I'm sorry I was such a bitch and didn't answer your messages. Can we start again? Do I dare come up there to see you?"
"Whenever you like."
"Do I need to bring along a rifle with wolf shot?"
"Not at all. We'll have our own laps, dog teams and all the gear. When are you coming?"
"Friday evening, okay?"
Apart from the narrow, shoveled path to the door, there was about 3 feet of snow covering the property. Blomqvist gave the shovel a long, critical look, and then went over to Nielsen's house to ask whether Berger could park her BMW there. There was no problem. They had room in the double garage, and they even had engine heaters. Berger drove through the afternoon and arrived around 6. They stared at each other warily for several seconds, and then hugged each other for much longer. There was not much to see in the darkness except the illuminated church, and both Consum and Suzanne's Bridge Café were closing up, so they hurried home. Blomqvist cooked dinner while Berger poked around in his house, making remarks about the issues of Record Magasinet from the 50s that were still there, and getting engrossed in his files in the office. They had lamb cutlets with potatoes in cream sauce and drank red wine. Blomqvist tried to take up the thread of their earlier conversation, but Berger was in no mood to discuss Millennium. Instead, they talked for 2 hours about what Blomqvist was doing up there and how he and Wanger were getting on. Later, they went up to see if the bed was big enough to hold both of them. Her third meeting with advocate Nils Bjurman was rescheduled, and finally set for 5 on that same Friday afternoon. At the previous meeting, Salander was greeted by a middle-aged woman who smelled of musk and worked as his secretary. At this time she had left for the day, and Bjurman smelled faintly of drink. He waved Salander to a visitor's chair and leafed distractedly through the documents on his desk until he seemed suddenly to become aware of her presence. It turned out to be another interrogation. This time he asked Salander about her sex life, which she had no intention of discussing with anyone. After the meeting she knew that she had handled it badly. At first she refused to answer his questions. His interpretation of this was that she was shy, retarded, or had something to hide, and he pressed her for answers. Salander realized that he was not going to give up, so she started giving him brief, colourless answers of the sort she assumed would fit with her psychological profile. She mentioned Magnus, who, according to her description, was a nerdy computer programmer her own age, who treated her like a gentleman should, took her to the cinema, and sometimes shared her bed. Magnus was fiction. She made him up as she went along, but Bjurman took her account as a pretext for meticulously mapping out her sex life.
"How often do you have sex?"
"Occasionally."
"Who takes the initiative, you or him?"
"I do."
"Do you use condoms?"
"Of course." She knew about HIV.
"What's your favourite position?"
Usually on my back.
"Do you enjoy oral sex?"
Wait a second.
"Have you ever had anal sex?"
"No, it's not particularly nice to be fucked in the arse. But what the hell business is it of yours?" That was the only time she lost her temper. She kept her eyes on the floor so they would not betray her exasperation. When she looked at him again, he was grinning at her from across the desk. She left his office with a feeling of disgust. Palmgren would never have dreamed of asking such questions. On the other hand, he had always been there if she had wanted to discuss anything. Not that she did. Bjurman was on his way to being a major problem.
Chapter 11. Saturday, February 1st to Tuesday, February 18th. During the brief hours of daylight on Saturday, Blomqvist and Berger took a walk past the small boat harbour along the road to Östergården. He had been living on Hedeby Island for a month, but he had never taken a walk inland. The freezing temperatures and regular snowstorms had deterred him. But Saturday was sunny and pleasant. It was as if Berger had brought with her a hint of spring. The road was lined with snow, ploughed 3 feet high. As soon as they left the summer cabin area, they were walking in dense fir forest. Blomqvist was surprised by how much higher and more inaccessible Söderberget, the hill across from the cabins, was than it appeared from the village. He thought about how many times Harriet Wanger must have played here as a child. But then he pushed all thoughts of her out of his mind. After about a mile, the woods ended at a fence where the Östergården farmland began. They could see a white wooden structure and red farm buildings arranged in a square. They turned to head back the same way. As they passed the driveway to the estate house, Wanger knocked on the upstairs window and gestured firmly for them to come up. Blomqvist and Berger looked at each other.
"Would you like to meet a corporate legend?" Blomqvist said.
"Does he bite?"
"Not on Saturdays."
Wanger received them at the door to his office.
"You must be Frukenberger. I recognize you," he said. "Mikhail didn't say a word about your coming to Hedeby."
One of Berger's outstanding talents was her ability to instantly get on friendly terms with the most unlikely individuals. Blomqvist had seen her turn on the charm for 5-year-old boys, who within 10 minutes were fully prepared to abandon their mothers. Men over 80 seemed not to be an exception. After 2 minutes, Berger and Henrik Wanger were ignoring Blomqvist as they chatted on. It was as if they had known each other since childhood. Well, since Erika's childhood, at any rate. Berger started off quite boldly by scolding Wanger for luring her publisher away into the sticks. The old man replied that as far as he could tell, from assorted press reports, she had in fact fired him. And had she not done so, then now might be high time to get rid of excess ballast in the editorial offices. And in that case, Wanger said, a period of rustic life would do young Blomqvist some good. For 5 minutes they discussed Blomqvist's shortcomings in the most irritating terms. Blomqvist leaned back and pretended to be insulted, but he frowned when Berger made some cryptic remarks that might allude to his failings as a journalist, but might also have applied to sexual prowess. Wanger tilted his head back and roared with laughter. Blomqvist was astonished.
He had never seen Wanger so natural and relaxed. He could suddenly see that Wanger, 50 years younger, or even 30 years, must have been quite a charming, attractive, ladies' man. He had never remarried. There must have been women who crossed his path, yet for nearly half a century he had remained a bachelor. Blomqvist took a sip of coffee and pricked up his ears again when he realized that the conversation had suddenly turned serious and had to do with Millennium.
"Mikhail has told me that you're having problems at the magazine."
Berger glanced at Blomqvist.
"No, he hasn't discussed your internal operations. But a person would have to be deaf and blind not to see that your magazine, just like the Wanger Corporation, is in difficulties."
"I'm confident that we can repair the situation," Berger said.
"I doubt it,"
Wanger said. "Why is that?"
"Let's see. How many employees do you have? 6? A monthly magazine with a print run of 21,000? Manufacturing costs, salaries, distribution, offices. You need revenues of about 10 million. I think we know what percentage of that amount has to come from advertising revenue."
"So?"
"So friend Venestrom is a vengeful and narrow-minded bastard who isn't going to forget his recent contretemps in a hurry. How many advertisers have you lost in the past 6 months?"
Berger regarded Wanger with a wary expression. Blomqvist caught himself holding his breath. On those occasions when he and the old man had touched on the future of Millennium, it had always concerned annoying remarks or the magazine's situation in relation to Blomqvist's ability to finish his work in Hedestad. But Wanger was now addressing Erika alone, one boss to another. Signals passed between them that Blomqvist could not interpret, which might have had to do with the fact that he was basically a poor working-class boy from Norland, and she was an upper-class girl with a distinguished international family tree.
"Could I have a little more coffee?" Berger asked.
Wanger poured her a cup at once.
"Okay. You've done your homework. We're bleeding."
"How long?"
"We've got 6 months to turn ourselves around. 8 months max. We don't have enough capital to keep ourselves afloat longer than that."
The old man's expression was inscrutable as he stared out of the window. The church was still standing there.
"Did you know that I was once in the newspaper business?"
he said, once more addressing them both. Blomqvist and Berger both shook their heads. Wanger laughed again, ruefully.
"We owned 6 daily newspapers in Norland. That was back in the '50s and '60s. It was my father's idea. He thought it might be politically advantageous to have a section of the media behind us. We're actually still one of the owners of the Hedestad Courier. Berger is the chairman of the board for the group of owners. Harold's son," he added, for Blomqvist's benefit.
"And also a local politician," Blomqvist said.
"Martin is on the board, too. He keeps Berger in line."
"Why did you let go of the newspapers you owned?" Blomqvist asked.
"Corporate restructuring in the '60s. Publishing newspapers was in some ways more a hobby than an interest. When we needed to tighten the budget, it was one of the first assets that we sold. But I know what it takes to run a publication. May I ask you a personal question?"
This was directed at Erika.
"I haven't asked Mikhail about this, and if you don't want to answer, you don't have to. I'd like to know how you ended up in this quagmire. Did you have a story, or didn't you?"
Now it was Blomqvist's turn to look inscrutable. Berger hesitated only a second before she said,
"We had a story, but it was a very different story."
Wanger nodded, as if he understood precisely what Berger was saying. Blomqvist did not. "I don't want to discuss the matter," Blomqvist cut the discussion short. "I did the research and wrote the article. I had all the sources I needed. But then it all went to hell."
"You had sources for every last thing you wrote?"
"I did." Wanger's voice was suddenly sharp.
"I won't pretend to understand how the hell you could walk into such a minefield. I can't recall a similar story, except perhaps the Lundahl affair in Expressen in the '60s, if you youngsters have ever heard of it. Was your source also a mythomaniac?"
He shook his head and turned to Berger and said quietly,
"I've been a newspaper publisher in the past, and I can be one again. What would you say to taking on another partner?"
The question came like a bolt out of the blue, but Berger did not seem the least bit surprised.
"Tell me more," she said.
Wanger said,
"How long are you staying in Hedestad?"
I'm going home tomorrow.
Would you consider, you and Mikhail, of course, humouring an old man by joining me for dinner tonight? Would 7 suit?
That would suit us fine. We'd love it. But you're not answering the question I asked. Why would you want to be a partner in Millennium?
I'm not avoiding the question. I just thought we could discuss it over dinner. I have to talk with my lawyer before I can put together a concrete offer, but in all simplicity I can say that I have money to invest. If the magazine survives and starts making a profit again, then I'll come out ahead. If not, well, I've had significantly bigger losses in my day.
Blomqvist was about to open his mouth when Berga put her hand on his knee.
Mikhail and I have fought hard so that we could be completely independent.
Nonsense. No one is completely independent. But I'm not out to take over the magazine, and I don't give a damn about the contents. That bastard Stenbeck got all sorts of points for publishing Modern Times, so why can't I back Millennium, which happens to be an excellent magazine, by the way.
Does this have anything to do with Venestrom? Blomqvist said. Wanger smiled.
Mikhail, I'm 80 years plus. There are things I regret not doing, and people I regret not fighting more. But apropos this topic,
he turned to Berger again.
This type of investment would have at least one condition.
Let's hear it,
Berger said.
Mikhail Blomqvist must resume his position as publisher.
No, Blomqvist snapped.
But yes, Wanger said equally curt. Wennerström will have a stroke if we send out a press release saying that the Wanger Corporation is backing Millennium, and at the same time you're returning as publisher. That's absolutely the clearest signal we could send. Everyone will understand that it's not a takeover, and that the editorial policies won't change. And that alone will give the advertisers who are thinking of pulling out reason to reconsider. Wennerström isn't omnipotent. He has enemies too. And there are companies new to you that will consider taking space.
What the hell was that all about? Blomqvist said as soon as Berger pulled the front door shut.
I think it's what you call advance probes for a business deal, she said. You didn't tell me that Henrik Wanger is such a sweetie.
Blomqvist planted himself in front of her. Ricky, you knew exactly what this conversation was going to be about.
Hey, toy boy, it's only 3 and I want to be properly entertained before dinner.
Blomqvist was enraged, but he had never managed to be enraged at Erika Berger for very long. She wore a black dress, a waist-length jacket and pumps, which she just happened to have brought along in her little suitcase. She insisted that Blomqvist wear a jacket and tie. He put on his black trousers, a grey shirt, dark tie and grey sports coat. When they knocked punctually on the door of Wanger's home, it turned out that Dirk Frode and Martin Wanger were also among the guests. Everyone was wearing a jacket and tie, except for Wanger.
"The advantage of being over 80 is that no one can criticize what you wear," he declared.
He wore a bow tie and a brown cardigan. Berger was in high spirits throughout the dinner. It was not until they moved to the drawing room with a fireplace and cognac was poured that the discussion took on a serious tone. They talked for almost 2 hours before they had the outline for a deal on the table. Frode would set up a company to be wholly owned by Henrik Wanger. The board would consist of Henrik and Martin Wanger and Frode. Over a 4-year period, this company would invest a sum of money that would cover the gap between income and expenses for Millennium. The money would come from Wanger's personal assets. In return, Wanger would have a conspicuous position on the magazine's board. The agreement would be valid for 4 years, but it could be terminated by Millennium after 2 years. But this type of premature termination would be costly, since Wanger could only be bought out by repayment of the sum he had invested. In the event of Wanger's death, Martin Wanger would replace him on the Millennium board for the remainder of the period during which the agreement was valid. If Martin wished to continue his involvement beyond this period, he could make that decision himself when the time came. He seemed amused by the prospect of getting even with Wennerström. And Blomqvist wondered again what the origin was of the animosity between those two. Martin refilled their glasses. Wanger made a point of leaning towards Blomqvist and in a low voice told him that this new arrangement had no effect whatsoever on the agreement that existed between them. Blomqvist could resume his duties as publisher full-time at the end of the year. It was also decided that the reorganization, in order to have the greatest impact in the media, should be presented on the same day that Blomqvist began his prison sentence in mid-March. Combining a strongly negative event with a reorganization was, in PR terms, such a clumsy error that it could not but astonish Blomqvist's detractors and garner optimum attention for Henrik Wanger's new role. But everyone also saw the logic in it. It was a way of indicating that the yellow plague flag fluttering over Millennium's editorial offices was about to be hauled down. The magazine had backers who were willing to be ruthless. The Wanger Corporation might be in a crisis, but it was still a prominent industrial firm which could go on the offense if the need arose. The whole conversation was a discussion between Berger on one side and Henrik and Martin Wanger on the other. No one asked Blomqvist what he thought. Late that night, Blomqvist lay with his head resting on Erika's breasts, looking into her eyes. "How long have you and Henrik Wanger been discussing this arrangement?"
"About a week," she said, smiling.
"Is Krista in agreement?"
"Of course."
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"Why in the world should I discuss it with you? You resigned as publisher, you left the editorial staff and the board, and you went to live in the woods."
"So I deserve to be treated like an idiot?"
"Oh yes," she said. "Decidedly you do."
"You really have been mad at me."
"Mikhail, I've never felt so furious, so abandoned, and so betrayed as when you left. I've never been this upset with you before."
She took a firm grip on his hair and then shoved him farther down in the bed. By the time Berger left here to be on Sunday, Blomqvist was still so annoyed with Wanger that he did not want to risk running into either him or any other member of his clan. Instead, on Monday, he took the bus into Hedestad and spent the afternoon walking in the town, visiting the library, and drinking coffee in a bakery. In the evening he went to the cinema to see The Lord of the Rings, which he had never before had time to see. He thought that orcs, unlike human beings, were simple and uncomplicated creatures. He ended his outing at McDonald's in Hedestad and caught the last bus to Hedeby. He made coffee, took out a binder, and sat at the kitchen table. He read until 4 in the morning. There were a number of questions regarding the investigation that seemed increasingly odd the further Blomqvist went through the documents. They were not revolutionary discoveries that he made all on his own. They were problems that had preoccupied Inspector Morell for long periods, especially in his free time. During the last year of her life, Harriet had changed. In some ways, this change could be explained as the change that everyone goes through in one form or another during their teenage years. Harriet was growing up. Classmates, teachers, and several members of the family, however, all testified that she had turned in on herself and become uncommunicative. The girl who, 2 years earlier, was a lively teenager, had begun to distance herself from everyone around her. In school she still spent time with her friends, but now she behaved in an impersonal manner, as one of her friends described it. This word was unusual enough for Morell to have made a note of it and then ask more questions. The explanation he got was that Harriet had stopped talking about herself, stopped gossiping, and stopped confiding in her friends. Harriet Wanger had been a Christian, in a child's sense of the word, attending Sunday school, saying evening prayers, and becoming confirmed. In her last year she seemed to have become yet more religious. She read the Bible and went regularly to church. But she had not turned to Hedeby Island's pastor, Otto Falk, who was a friend of the Wanger family. Instead, during the spring she had sought out a Pentecostal congregation in Hedestad. Yet her involvement in the Pentecostal church did not last long. After only 2 months she left the congregation and instead began reading books about the Catholic faith. The religious infatuation of a teenager? Perhaps. But no one else in the Wanger family had ever been noticeably religious, and it was difficult to discern what impulses may have guided her. One explanation for her interest in God could, of course, have been that her father had drowned the previous year. Morell came to the conclusion that something had happened in Harriet's life that was troubling her or affecting her. Morell, like Wanger, had devoted a great deal of time to talking to Harriet's friends, trying to find someone in whom she might have confided. Some measure of hope was pinned on Anita Wanger, 2 years older than Harriet and the daughter of Harold.
She had spent the summer of 1966 on Hedeby Island, and they were thought to be close friends, but Anita had no solid information to offer. They had hung out together that summer, swimming, taking walks, talking about movies, pop bands, and books. Harriet had sometimes gone